Broad outlines of these three modern views, and in some ways they explain more the attitudes of the proponents than they do the ancient conditions themselves. Theodore Mommsen's, for instance, his imperialistic, his defensive imperialistic view is quite appealing to the mentality of 19th century European imperialists, who are themselves nursing empires all around the world. Harris's aggressive Romans, nasty imperialistic Romans, nicely fits in with the post-colonial, post-Vietnam War, post-Nixon suspicion of authority context in which the book was written. And of course, the modern systems analysis derived from the sciences fits our computer age quite nicely. As a result, you could say in some way that while these views aren't in themselves wrong, they're more reflective of current conditions than they are of ancient ones. For my own view, and this may be considered overly naive by some, but my own view is to go back and look at what the ancients themselves thought about power wielding and so forth, looking at ancient conditions rather than coming at the subject with preconceived modern notions. If we look at the history of the ancient Mediterranean, hierarchy was at the core of ancient Mediterranean societies. It, in many ways, dictated the internal relationships between elements within ancient Mediterranean societies. It should hardly surprise us, then, if it also determined the relationships between those societies. The notion that the strong have advantages over the weak is fundamental to ancient Mediterranean societies. Its best expression is in Thucydides, in the late 5th century BC, a Greek writer describing the Athenians attacking the inconsequential island of Melos, which will not join their empire. The Melians, says Thucydides, say, why? Why are you coming here, a democratic power, to tell us what to do? Why won't you just leave us alone? And the Athenians respond, well, we're coming here because we can. Because it's the natural order for the strong to rule the weak. Might is right. In fact, said the Athenians, if you Melians had our power, you'd be doing the same thing to us. This is really an encapsulation, in many ways, of a widespread ancient Mediterranean view. And if we look at the history of the Mediterranean as a whole, it is one of expansion or defeat. States either expanded or they were expanded upon. Very few states could exist in a happy neutrality, isolated and left alone, respected by their neighbours. If they happened to have strong neighbours, they tended to be governed and ruled by them. In my view, which I would call perhaps the pragmatic view, then the Romans simply behaved as any ancient state did. I think the systems analysis view has a lot going for it. Finding themselves in control of Italy with large pools of manpower available, with their penchant for organisation and adapting other people's ideas, they found themselves also in command of an extremely formidable military, and like any ancient state would, they put it to good use. I think then the best way to examine the rise of the Roman Empire is to take each war on its own merits, and try to examine as far as we can what the ancient Roman attitudes were towards embarking in that war. That they were not blind to the advantages to themselves is also true, but that they pursued a single-minded policy of expansion seems to me to be rather overstated. The Roman Empire, then, ultimately is a product of the ancient Mediterranean world as a whole. In short, the Romans did what most ancient states did, just that they did it best.
Lecture 16, The Captured Conqueror, Rome and Hellenism.
Hello again, and welcome to the 16th lecture in our History of Rome. We have now, at this stage, covered the rise of the Roman Empire. We have examined, as well, the reasons for it offered by both ancients and moderns. We saw that the ancient explanations were minimal. They seem to have assumed that it was just the way it should be. And what I want to do in this lecture, before looking at the constitution of the Roman Republic, at the nature of government of the Roman Republic, which is a vital subject for us to understand both Polybius's explanation for the rise of the Roman Empire, which, as we saw last time, was partly that the Roman government was so stable and well-balanced, but also will set the stage for the Roman Revolution, which we will be spending quite some time examining. I want to do, before we look at the Roman constitution, I want to examine the issue of Hellenization, the Hellenization of Rome, which was a major cultural event in these years. The poet Horace, who lived in the age of Augustus, turned a very memorable phrase when he wrote that captured Greece has captured her savage conqueror. The phrase, of course, refers to the process that modern scholars have termed Hellenization, the adoption by the Romans of Greek culture. I wish to examine this subject by, first of all, giving a brief overview of the early contacts between Greece, at least Greek culture, and Rome, and then taking the example of the life and career of our historian Polybius, as in some ways exemplary of the process of Hellenization as it took place at a personal level. We see that Polybius was not entirely atypical. Plenty of Greeks were coming to Rome in these years. And having examined that issue, we will also look at some other symptoms of Rome's Hellenization. Now, there are many that could be pointed out, but I wish to look specifically at the issue of education and the rise of Latin literature under Greek influence, and then briefly at Roman art and architecture in these years, which illustrates again the process of Hellenization. And then, to close the lecture, we'll examine the reaction, the complex Roman reaction to this cultural encounter with the Greeks. We'll see that while many Romans were delighted and enthusiastically embraced the sophisticated Greek culture, there was a traditionalist backlash, a conservative backlash against it. And as the paradigm of that backlash, we'll examine the life, career, and attitudes of Cato the Censor. Okay then, to begin then, it must be stated straight out that Hellenization, the Hellenization of Rome, is not a straightforward process that starts in X BC and ends in Y BC. It's a long and complicated process that has no real clear beginning, or for that matter, any clear ending. By the end of the 1st century BC, perhaps even the middle of the 1st century BC, it was largely complete. At that stage, the Romans had fully embraced and adopted many aspects of Greek culture and evolved a very distinctive Latin literature under Greek influence. But the precise beginnings of Hellenization are much more unclear to us. It used to be believed that the Hellenization of Rome really got underway in the 3rd, 2nd centuries BC when the Romans conquered the Greek world, when they encountered the Greek city-states of southern Italy and then eventually moved eastward into the Mediterranean heartland in the Aegean heartland of the Greek world. But actually, of course, we have seen that the Romans had close encounters with the Etruscans long before that, and that the Etruscans were themselves heavily Hellenized peoples. We noted, for instance, that the story of Aeneas, the legend of Aeneas, which is firmly rooted in a Greek context, centered on the Trojan War, one of the cardinal events in Greek cultural history, the subject of their national epics, the Iliad and Odyssey by Homer. This legend of Aeneas, which is one of the two foundation legends of Rome we saw, was already popular, at least in Latium, by the 4th century BC, as archaeological evidence from Lavinium suggests, for Aeneas was being worshipped as a god. So the process of Hellenization then goes back prior to the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC, at least its beginnings go back earlier, and undoubtedly the Romans were familiar with Greek culture primarily through the medium of their contacts with the Etruscans. Having said that, with increased Roman contact with the Greek world beginning in the 3rd century following the Pyrrhic War and then accelerating at the beginning of the 2nd century with the Macedonian Wars and so forth, there can be little doubt that the process of Hellenization was hurried along, that these encounters, these direct encounters with Greek lands, accelerated the process. So, in short then, it's a complex process with no clear beginning, no definite ending, but really largely complete by the mid-1st century BC, although we can't put a precise date on when Hellenization ended or when it began. In many ways, then, the life of the historian Polybius, the Greek historian Polybius, is illustrative of the encounters of the Greek and Roman worlds. Polybius was born around 200 BC in the Greek city of Megalopolis in the Peloponnese, son of a prominent statesman in the Achaean League. He was a typically urbane, educated Greek with mastery of oratory, of course, a master of his language, and he seemed to be destined towards a prominent career as an Achaean politician. Unfortunately for Polybius, following the Battle of Pydna in 168 BC and the Third Macedonian War, Roman suspicions of the Greeks south of the Macedonians were heightened by their apparent non-committal to the Roman cause during that war. And in the suspicious atmosphere, Polybius found himself denounced to the Romans by a pro-Roman opportunist politician, a man named Callicrates, who denounced Polybius and several hundred, indeed thousand, other politicians to the Romans as being potential traitors to them. And the Romans summoned several hundred of the chief suspects to Italy to undergo examination, where they basically were kept under house arrest as a form of hostage for the next 16 years without any trial or any direct charges being laid against them. Most of these Greek hostages were housed in towns in southern Etruria, but Polybius was fortunate enough to have made the acquaintance of a leading Roman of the day. The man's name was Publius Cornelius Scipio Aemilianus, and he was a son of the general who had been victorious at the Battle of Pydna. More than that, Publius Cornelius Scipio Aemilianus, henceforth Scipio Aemilianus, was the adopted son of Publius Cornelius Scipio, the son of the defeater of Hannibal. In other words, through this man, Polybius had connections to two of Rome's most important and influential noble families. And Scipio Aemilianus enjoyed the company of Polybius. They shared various cultural interests. And Polybius then lived out his hostage period in Rome, not in a small town in southern Etruria, but in the capital itself, as a friend and mentor of Scipio Aemilianus. He entered, in fact, a cultural circle that's often called the Scipionic Circle. Scipio Aemilianus was an enthusiastic drinker of Greek culture, and he surrounded himself with many educated men, Polybius just one among them. But Polybius, of course, then has access to all sorts of interesting first-hand information, archival material and so forth, in composing his histories, which we've seen are an invaluable source for this period. But what we want to focus on here is really the experience of Polybius, a man who is treated as sort of an honored guest by a leading Roman family who was greatly appreciative of Greek culture. And this is a clear sign of the Hellenization of the Romans. They greatly admired the sophisticated Greek culture, and there was so much to admire, it's hardly surprising. Polybius managed to accompany Scipio in various of his campaigns and travels. He saw Spain. He was there at the destruction of Carthage, when Scipio Aemilianus destroyed Carthage. More of that in a minute. And he also managed to travel to North Africa. We hear that he retraced Hannibal's route across the Alps personally, so as to write about it all the more accurately. So here he is, an educated, incisive Greek, basically being patronized by a leading Roman family. And Polybius' experience, while it might be exceptionally wealthy, is not entirely atypical of many Greeks of this era. As the Romans conquered the Greek lands, they took plenty of prisoners of war, plenty of Greek slaves. Many of these men were highly educated, far more educated indeed than the average legionary who was in the rank and file. And many of these slaves entered Roman families at a fairly high level of trust and status. They were slaves, to be sure, but they were often put in charge of the education of the children of Roman noble houses. And a good example of this is the slave known as Livius Andronicus, who was from Tarentum. He was a half-Greek from the Greek city-state of Tarentum in the south of Italy, who became a mentor to the children of a leading Roman senator in the late 3rd century BC. Andronicus is particularly important because he's generally believed to have been the first man to start Latin literature. The history of Latin literature is often dated to this man's activities, because he translated into Latin Homer's Odyssey. He took the epic poem of the Greeks and produced a Latin version of it. He also composed other Greek-style literary works, plays and so forth, in Latin, and so gave to the Romans a model, sort of a, I won't say it's much a blueprint, but certainly a model of various genres of literature, and so got the ball rolling on the history of Latin literature. Subsequent Roman authors, writing in Latin, consistently use Greek sources as their models. Most of the genres of Roman literature, with the exception of satire, are Latin versions of already existing Greek models. Plays, epic poems, elegiac poems, speeches, treatises, history, and so on and so forth. In addition to the translation of Greek sources or Greek models into Latin, and then the adaptation, it's important to stress that, the adaptation by Latin authors of Greek models. We're not talking about slavish copying here. Okay, Livius Andronicus had translated the Odyssey into Latin, but later Roman authors who used Greek models did just that. They took a Greek model, they took a Greek example, but they would forge something new and different. They would infuse it with Roman sensibilities, Roman values, and so forth, and of course use the Latin language. And as a result, the development of Latin literature, and in fact we'll see this theme again, the encounter generally, the encounter of Roman culture with Greek culture is not one of slavish copying, despite a widely popular view out there that the Romans got their culture from the Greeks. In fact, they didn't. They adapted much of their culture from the Greeks, and in doing so, they often created things that were distinctly Roman. And we'll see some examples of that in art and architecture shortly. But aside from the model of Livius Andronicus, who at least started out by translating Greek works into Latin, we also have the fact that many Roman aristocrats knew the Greek language. The first ever Roman historian, a man called Quintus Fabius Pictor, writing at the end of the 3rd century BC, around the same time as Livius Andronicus, wrote a history of Rome from earliest times onwards, and he wrote it in Greek. This was the language of the educated person, and we'll see, in fact, plenty of Greek-speaking aristocrats appearing in the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC. The rise of a Roman literature was facilitated by this continuing process of bringing Greeks into Roman aristocratic houses as teachers of their children, and this entailed a change in the way that Roman education operated. The traditional Roman education was a relentlessly practical education. A child was taught to swim and ride, given the rudiments, to be sure, of literacy and numeracy, enough to speak, at least convincingly, to his peers. He spent a lot of time, however, in physical education, physical training, and then when the youth had reached the age of about 14, he would adopt what was called the toga of manhood, the toga virilis, which marked his ascent to maturity. And at that point, he would embark on essentially what was an apprenticeship. He would accompany his father into the forum and start to observe the workings of public life. Court cases taking place in the forum, senatorial meetings and so forth, public assemblies. And he would also, of course, then, when reaching the age of maybe 17, perhaps a little bit younger, maybe 16, embark as well on a military career. Very important for an aspiring Roman noble to have a good and glorious military career behind one. And so as a result, basically, the traditional Roman education of children up to the age of about 14 was very practical. Not a lot of emphasis on sophistication and verbal training. However, with the appearance of Greek-style tutors and mentors in greater profusion among the Romans, this changed. And gradually, over the course of the 2nd and 1st centuries BC, Roman education became much more like a Greek-style education. Instead of being very practical, it now became incredibly verbal. The emphasis was on knowledge of words and the creation of a really effective rhetor, a really effective public speaker. This, of course, facilitated the growth of a Roman literature. People trained in this way will be more able to use words, and they'll be more able to read the Greek originals and then adapt those into Latin to form Latin literature. So it's, again, a complex procedure. Not any straight matter of cause and effect, but rather a complex interaction of events. In addition to the Greeks who came to Rome forcibly, increasing numbers of Greeks came to Rome voluntarily, as Rome became the center of the Mediterranean world politically and culturally. So too then would many embassies, for instance, come to Rome, seeking privileges from the Senate, asking favors, asking for reversal of adverse decisions, and so forth. And so plenty of well-educated, leading Greeks of their hometowns, would find themselves in Rome, waiting to meet with the Senate and make their case. And while doing so, they could often give public lectures to the interested public. One such person, for instance, was the famous philosopher Carneades of Cyrene. Cyrene was a Greek city-state in North Africa, and he was the head of the academy in Athens, which is equivalent, I suppose, to being president of Harvard University in the ancient world. This is a very prestigious academic position, and he came to Rome in 155 BC as part of an embassy, asking favors from the Senate, and dazzled, we hear, dazzled the Roman upper classes with his public lectures, with his erudition and his mastery of language. Often overlooked example of a similar sort of expert is the doctor Asclepiades of Bithynia. Bithynia is a kingdom in northern Turkey, and he came to Rome in the period about 130 BC and stayed for maybe three decades and rose to enormous prominence among the Romans with his medical theories. Obviously, ancient people were just as interested in modern people in trying to maintain health and stay healthy and so forth, and any new idea that would promote health was always listened to carefully. And Asclepiades had very interesting ideas. We haven't got the time to go into them now, but very interesting ideas, oddball theories in many ways about how health and how the physiology works, how health is maintained, are restored after it's been lost. And he became enormously popular. We hear, in fact, from one of his detractors who says, people believed him just as if he'd fallen out of the skies, as an apostle from heaven. So here we have at least two examples, and there are others, of Greeks who are coming to Rome and voluntarily and becoming very prominent, gaining positions of considerable prominence and popularity among the Romans, who were drinking up Greek culture, as much of it as they can get. Another avenue for Greek culture into the Roman sphere is through art and architecture. Obviously, as the Romans went abroad, they weren't shy to loot Greek cities that they had conquered, and they often would bring back works of art. And the desire of Romans to own Greek works of art, to display them in their houses and on their public buildings, really grows greatly in this period. For instance, Greek sculpture was greatly admired and came back in large numbers from the wars of expansion in the Eastern Mediterranean, large quantities of Greek sculpture crossing the Mediterranean into Italy, where it was displayed often in people's private houses or on public buildings, and was then copied. People who couldn't afford the original would actually commission copies. And in fact, it's our study of Greek sculpture is largely based upon studying Roman copies of now lost Greek originals. Nearly all of the Greek sculptures that you see displayed in the Art of Greece history books will be Roman copies of Greek originals. So the Romans prized Greek works of art, whether they be originals or copies, and they circulated widely among the Roman nobles. In addition, at this time, Roman public architecture becomes highly Hellenized. What we find are the Greek-style orders of columns coming into play, the use of marble. For the first time, we hear in 146 BC, when a Roman general with the wonderful name Quintus Caecilius Metellus Macedonicus refurbished the Temple of Jupiter Stator in Rome in marble. This is, in our literary sources, the first occasion when marble was used in public architecture. Once introduced, it was used repeatedly and continually by the Romans, who also adopted the Greek architectural orders, the Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian orders, and began to use them to decorate their public spaces. But again, this is not a slavish copy. We're not talking about the Romans building Greek temples in Rome. They built traditional Roman-style temples with Greek decoration and with Greek elements attached. The Roman temple, for instance, was originally derived from Etruscan models and was marked by standing on a high podium with a high degree of what architectural historians call frontality, a large set of steps at the front, but the temple otherwise inaccessible from the sides and the back, standing on a podium. This is basically an Etruscan model, and the Etruscans originally built their temples in wood, later in simple stone, with terracotta, clay, painted clay decoration. Well, when the Romans began to Hellenize, they built those styles of temples. They were still raised in podiums. They still had the steps up the front. This is the big difference between Greek-style and Roman-style temples, this facet of frontality. But now they built them with marble columns, and the columns were in Greek-style orders. So while they look superficially Greek, they're still distinctly Roman. The temples, in many ways, then reflect this process of adaptation, not slavish copying, adaptation of Greek models to develop something new, something different. The elaboration of Roman architecture, especially public architecture, really gets underway, of course, under the emperors. But already in the 2nd and the 1st century BC, we see increasingly more lavish and extravagant public buildings, more and more being decorated with marbles in the Greek style going up in Rome. The Roman reaction to this whole process of Hellenization, if we just take the examples I've looked at, there are others, of course, that could have been looked at, we haven't got time for. But the Roman reaction to this process, this overall process, was mixed and complex. Most Roman aristocrats favored Greek culture. This is why they took educated Greek slaves and put them in control of the education of their own children. This is why Scipio Aemilianus welcomed Polybius as a guest and kept him in his circle almost as an equal. We hear, for instance, that when Carneades, this is the famous philosopher who came to Rome in 155, when he showed up at Rome, Plutarch, in his life of Cato, Cato the Elder, tells us, quote, when these philosophers arrived, all the young Romans who had any taste for literature hurried to frequent their company and listen to them with delight and wonder. Most Romans were gratified by this and were well content to see their sons embrace Greek culture and frequent the society of such estimable men. But we'll see, Cato was deeply disturbed. More of that in a minute. The point is that in this quote, most Romans, in Plutarch's view, embrace Greek culture. They're happy to see such educated men training and helping their sons. It's also well worth noting, a good anecdote to illustrate this, is well worth noting the story that Scipio Aemilianus, when he's watching Carthage burn, he's watching the city be destroyed, he starts to contemplate, we hear. He starts to cry, and he contemplates on the fate of cities, thinking perhaps one day this will be the fate of Rome. Maybe this will happen one day to us. Here's Carthage, once so proud and powerful, and now look at it, reduced to rubble at our hands. Maybe one day this will happen to us. And what does he use to express these emotions? Polybius is our source for this. He was there. He witnessed it. What does he use to express his emotions? Two lines from Homer's Iliad in the Greek. The day shall come when sacred Troy is destroyed, and Priam, and the people of spear-bearing Priam. He chooses Greek words to express his emotions. A larger question is to what degree this process of Hellenization, this acculturation by the Romans to Greek culture, was ongoing among the lower orders. There are some scholars who believe this is purely a fad among the aristocrats. I don't subscribe to that view, because alongside elevated Greeks who were coming to Rome, many thousands of lower class Greeks were also coming to Rome, either as slaves or as people trying to find a new life for themselves, going to the center, the new center of power and influence in the world. We know, for instance, that there was a large Jewish population of Rome, Greek-speaking Jewish population in the city, in the lower orders. It must have been that in the seething ghettos of the lower orders in Rome, plenty of Greeks were to be found there, and plenty of Romans were encountering new and interesting ideas, maybe food styles and so on, ways of dressing. And it's my belief as well that they were also encountering the Greek penchant for bathing and public bathing, which is something that we'll come back to in a later lecture. So it's quite possible then that the lower orders were also becoming, in their own way, attuned to Greek sensibilities. Well, if many Romans were exuberantly embracing Greek culture, there was also something of a traditionalist, nationalist, if you want to think of it that way, counter-reaction, as symbolized by Marcus Porcius Cato Censorinus, or Cato the Elder. Cato was a tough, old-style Italian from the town of Tusculum. He was born in 234 BC and lived to the ripe old age of, well, he lived until 139 BC. I haven't got the time to do the mathematics, but it was a ripe old age for the ancient world. He was a very traditional Roman. He took part in public affairs. He was a senator. He fought hard in the army. He was there, for instance, as part of the army that threw Antiochus out of Greece in 190 BC. And he valued the old traditional Roman values, severity, seriousness, devotion to duty and public life, hard work, frugality, lack of greed, and so forth. He found Greek culture vapid and frivolous. Here were men who questioned everything. It doesn't make for a good soldier if the soldier's questioning the orders of the superior. The Roman values of devotion to duty and public life, he felt, were undermined by these Greek values, by these Greeks who came to our city questioning everything, questioning the value of truth, questioning the value of service, questioning the nature of existence. We're told, for instance, that he deliberately educated his son in the old style. He did not take a Greek into his house, or so we hear, and he educated his son himself. He trained his son to ride and fight with the sword and swim and so forth, and deliberately kept him shielded from the influence of the Greeks. When Carneades, the academic, came to Rome, as we've seen, dazzled the youth of the city, Cato was horrified. He was horrified that the young man could be influenced by such thinking, and in fact he organized it so that Carneades and other Greek philosophers were expelled from the city by a decree of the Senate as a bad influence on the Roman youth. He had a particular dislike and hatred of Greek-style doctors who he thought were given over to harebrained theories and schemes, and he favored rather the traditional Roman-style medicine based on herbal remedies and plenty of magic. What's so interesting about Cato is, despite all this public posturing, this anti-Greek, how bad and weak and weakening, enervating Greek culture is for us, despite all of this bluster and blunder, it's remarkable how well he knew Greek literature. He could cite specific examples when he wanted to say that Greek literature was frivolous and empty. He shows a fairly intimate knowledge of Greek philosophy. And he wrote his own works of literature in Latin in a deliberately rustic and archaic, rough style that seems to be a conscious effort to counter sophisticated, smooth Greek style. In other words, for all of his railings against Greek language and culture, he seems to be terribly familiar with it. So maybe Cato's position is a public position, a position adopted for the sake of political, social, cultural reasons. It doesn't actually reflect perhaps a private interest in Greek culture on Cato's part. In sum, then, the Hellenization of Rome is a complex process and should not be oversimplified as a one-way juggernaut of Greek culture running over the Romans, or, for that matter, the Romans just taking Greek culture on board wholesale. It's a process of adaptation. It's a process of adoption. It's a process, broadly speaking, as anthropologists would say, of acculturation.
Lecture 17, Governing the Roman Republic, Part 1, Senate and Magistrates.
Hello again, and welcome to the History of Ancient Rome. We've reached Lecture 17 now, in which I want to examine the other half of Polybius's explanation for the rise of the Roman Empire, and also set the stage for the Roman Revolution, which will occupy our attention for several lectures to come. In this and the next lecture, I want to review the system of government of the Roman Republic. It's worth looking at the system in detail, not only because the structural elements of it play such a prominent role in the course of the Roman Revolution, but also because it's a system that was well known to many later people who were founding polities and devising governmental systems, not least the founders of the United States of America, and offered, in some ways, models for those later political systems to follow. Having briefly given something of an overview of the Roman Republican government, I want to look today at the Senate and the magistrates of the Roman Republic before, in the next lecture, examining the popular assemblies, and then having an overview of how the system worked. The first thing to appreciate about the Roman Republic is that it was not a written constitution. It was instead a product of evolution. We have seen already the struggle of the orders and the expansion of Rome in Italy and in the Mediterranean. These two processes were the cardinal shapers of the Roman Republican system of government. No Roman could go along and see where it was written that this should be done this way or that should be done that way. Rather, it was a system of agreed upon practices, traditional ways of doing things that everyone knew and appreciated and supported for the most part, and very few people questioned. It had shaped and evolved, formed over several centuries. We saw, for instance, in the struggle of the orders, how the plebeians had originally created a parallel state, the plebeian state, so-called, made up of a council of plebs, a assembly of plebeian citizens, with officers attached, tribunes and aediles, and how eventually that plebeian state had come to be amalgamated, folded in to the main Roman Republic. So the struggle of the orders then gave the later fully developed republic one whole wing of government that hadn't been there before. No one decided to write this into the constitution. It happened as a consequence of historical circumstances. Likewise, the expansion of Rome in Italy and beyond exerted a tremendous influence on the way the Roman Republic operated, which we will be appreciating shortly. So the system that I want to outline to you, given that this is a product of evolution, which was ongoing, it didn't really ever stop, it was always changing and adapting, the portrait that I want to paint of the Roman Republic is in some ways misleading, because I have to sort of give you a broad overview of the system. It might be something of a conflation, broadly showing you what the system is like around the period 150 to 100 BC. But there are elements that I'll mention that only came in slightly later, but let's not worry about that. Suffice it to say that I'm going to be taking sort of a snapshot view of the system that hopefully will explain to you the broad shape of the Roman Republic and how it worked. But do be aware that the process of evolution didn't suddenly stop. It was ongoing beyond the period that we're looking at strictly today. The shape of the Roman government as well, the shape of the Republic, was partly a product of the nature of the Romans themselves. They were very dichotomous in their outlook. They were at once innovative, adaptive, and dynamic people, but they were also extremely conservative. Probably the best guess for what the Romans themselves called their system of government is the mos maiorum, the way or habit or custom of the ancestors. This is a very conservative name for a system of government, basically the way the elders did it. At the same time, they were always willing and ready to adapt and change and modify the system as circumstances demanded. So it's a very interesting clash of characteristics within the Roman people themselves, highly conservative, looking back at the past and at the traditions that they've inherited, and extremely reverent of those traditions and ways of doing things, and yet always willing to adapt and change. The result of this is an extremely complex system full of redundancies. A great metaphor for the Roman Republic that I've read is that it's like a cluttered kitchen owned by an eccentric old man. The kitchen is full of old appliances and new appliances piled on top of each other. And to an outsider coming into the kitchen, it looks bizarre and impossible to understand. But for the old eccentric, it's perfectly logical. He knows exactly where everything fits and what the strengths and weaknesses of every appliance is. And as a result, he's quite comfortable in it, even if we, as outsiders coming in, would find it weird and strange. That's quite a nice metaphor, I think, for the Roman Republic. It's full of overlaps and redundancies, which I hope you will bear with me as we examine over the next two lectures. Okay then, looking at the design of the Roman Republic, in its broadest divisions, the system was comprised of two wings. There were meetings or gatherings of citizens, remembering all the time that by citizens I mean adult, male, fully enfranchised people, women, slaves, and foreigners not included. So you have meetings of full citizens on the one half, and then in the other half you have officers attached to those meetings. Most of the Roman officers were attached to one of the meetings called the Senate. These officers were called magistrates. But two sets of officers were attached to a different one of the meetings, the Council of the Plebs, the meeting of the Plebs. These officers were technically not magistrates. They were called tribunes and aediles of the plebs. All regular Roman magistrates were elected by popular vote, by a vote of a duly constituted popular assembly, and most of them held office for a single year. That then is the broadest shape of the Roman state. Gatherings or meetings of citizens and officers, executive officers, most of them called magistrates, attached to those meetings. Today I'd like to look at the Senate, and at the magistrates, that is to say, at the officers attached to the Senate. Tomorrow we'll examine the popular assemblies and the tribunes of the plebs and have a look at how the whole system worked. By the middle of the 2nd century BC, there is little doubt, the Senate was the preeminent body in the Roman state. Its origins are obscure. It appears to have been an advisory council to the king in its earliest form. The word Senate, by the way, senatus, is connected with the Latin word senex, which means old. And the senatus basically means the council of old men, council of men with experience. It appears to have been a body of noblemen, landowning aristocrats, who advised the king. The biggest debate about the early Senate is whether it was a standing body or an ad hoc committee. I don't intend to get into that debate, but there seems to be good evidence that the Senate only became a standing, regular standing body in the 4th century BC. Prior to that, it seems to have been convened as needed. Whatever the case about its origins, by 150 BC, it was the leading council of the state. Its members were formed from ex-magistrates, men who had been elected to one of the magistracies, and who also qualified in terms of wealth through a census that allowed them to stand for office and enter the Senate if elected. In other words, the Senate was comprised of the richest, most influential and experienced men in the Roman state. Since it provided Rome with its generals, leading politicians, orators and so forth, the Senate had acquired a dominance in the Roman state by virtue of the expansion of Rome in Italy and outside, in the rest of the Mediterranean. Since the Romans had been pretty much constantly at war, naturally enough, the people had looked to their leaders, their generals, and their politicians for leadership in these times of war, and the Senate had acquired, through consensus, I suppose, and through historical circumstances, a preeminence in the state. It was not a legislated preeminence. There was no law that said the Senate is the leading body in the state. Rather, it had happened. It had just come out that way. Had Rome not been so imperialistic, had Rome not expanded in Italy and the Mediterranean, perhaps the Senate wouldn't have been as dominant as it was by the middle 2nd century, but Rome had expanded and the Senate was dominant. So it often strikes, certainly my students when they teach this course at Penn State, it strikes them as really striking and unusual to hear that, in fact, the Senate had no legislative powers at all. The Senate could not pass any laws that were binding on anyone. All the Senate could do was issue advice. Its original function, remember, was to advise kings, and then to advise magistrates on how to act. It issued its advice in the forms of senatorial decrees, the Latin is senatus consulta, which means literally pieces of advice of the Senate. Things that have been discussed by senators, decided upon, and here's what we think should be done. These senatorial decrees were not legally binding. However, due to the circumstance of the Senate's gradual or evolved political preeminence in the state, it usually happened that its pieces of advice, that its decrees, were acted upon and became law through a popular vote. More of that, however, later. So in sum, then, the Senate is comprised of the leading men of the state. It has, surprisingly, no legal powers to pass laws or legislate in any way. Rather, it issues decrees, which are essentially pieces of advice, which then have to be picked up by other officers and voted on by the people before they become law. However, because of the Senate's political dominance in the state, as it evolved over the centuries of Rome's expansion in Italy and in the Mediterranean, the Senate's political dominance meant that its advice was habitually picked up and transformed into law. But there is actually a two-stage process there, and that'll become very important when we examine the Roman Revolution. What about the magistrates? Well, the magistrates of the Roman Senate, the ones attached to the Roman Senate, were the most prestigious officers in the state. There were two key concepts inherent in all office holding in Rome, be they the magistrates or the tribunes or aediles of the plebs. Two key concepts that characterized office holding in the Roman Republic. Those concepts are collegiality and limited tenure of office. Since the Roman Republic had emerged as a reaction to monarchy, from the very start, we hear, there were always at least two leading magistrates. And as the system evolved and more magistracies came to be added to it, there were always more than one magistrate holding office at any one time. A Roman magistrate always had minimum of one other colleague in office with the same powers that he had, which meant that he had a power of veto over any action that his colleague might take, or his colleague had a power of veto over any action that he might take. It was a way of ensuring that it would be very difficult for someone to try to subvert the state. If you try to do so in any kind of a constitutional fashion, your actions can simply be vetoed and stopped. The other concept of power sharing in the Roman Republic was limited tenure of office. Most Roman magistrates held office only for 1 year. This served two important functions. First of all, again, if you're a revolutionary consul or other high office, you only had 12 months to enact your revolutionary agenda, and of course it could be vetoed at any stage by your colleagues. But secondly, and no less importantly, the limited tenure of office ensured that authority and responsibility, office holding in the Roman Republic, rotated frequently among the members of the aristocracy. One of the key concepts that the aristocracy cleaved to desperately was the notion of libertas, freedom. For them, freedom really meant equality among each other. No one of them could become so powerful as to emulate the role of, say, the former kings. The word rex, king, was a curse word in the Roman political vocabulary. So limited tenure of office ensured that every year new sets of magistrates would be elected. Laws were enacted that stipulated one had to wait a certain number of years before one could stand for the same office again. This is designed solely to ensure that no one person gets too powerful, that the authority and responsibility of office holding is frequently shared out among the aristocrats in the Senate. So collegiality and limited tenure of office then, two cardinal characteristics of Roman office holding, and at the core of the power sharing concept of the magistracies of ancient Roman Republic. Let's look at the magistrates themselves. The magistrates were carefully ranked in what was called the cursus honorum, the run of offices. That phrase, by the way, reveals something else about Roman office holding that we should note. Officers were considered honours. They were considered something that one did out of a sense of public duty. Roman magistrates were not paid. There was no payment for public service in the Roman Republic. You did it literally in your spare time. Your wealth was derived from your landowning and your estate owning and so forth. And if you held office, it was an honour. As a result, the word for office in Latin is honus, honor. So the run of offices then was a strict regulation that, again, it evolved over time, but I'm just giving you the sort of final version of it, was a strict regulation of the sequence in which one could hold office. It was determined by regulations of wealth. Property qualifications were required before you could even stand for office. You had to have a minimum property qualification to stand for office. Age and experience. And the system of the run of offices was designed to channel the least experienced members of the government up, giving them more and more experience and responsibility until when they finally stood for the high offices of state, they would have had plenty of administrative experience behind them. So if you wanted to stand for office, if you're a typical Roman nobleman, you're young and you want to stand for office, you must first of all have the proper property qualification, the minimum property qualification. When you reached your 25th year, you could stand for the first office in the cursus. This was called the quaestorship. It was a minor office. It involved maintenance of the state archives and overseeing of the state treasuries and finances. As I say, you had to be at least 25 years of age. You had to have the property qualification. It would be preferable if you had some military experience to trumpet when you went before the people for election. And once you were elected, you'd be elected with 9 other colleagues. There were 10 quaestors every year, and you would hold the office for a year. After that, you were then entitled to sit in on the Senate. Once you embarked on your career, the next office that you could aim at was the aedileship. We've seen the aediles were introduced through the plebeian state, but there were also two patrician aediles called curule aediles. So there were four in total elected every year. To be an aedile, you had to at least have held the quaestorship. So it was impossible for you to stand for the aedileship first. You had to have at least been elected and held the office of quaestor, and you had to be at least 36 years of age. Four of them were chosen every year, and they oversaw the physical fabric of the city. They gave games, and they also were responsible for seeing that the marketplace ran smoothly and that there was no shady dealing in the market. After the aedileship came the praetorship. This was the first of the really important offices. To be a praetor, you had to have held at least the quaestorship. This meant that the aedileship was effectively an optional office. It wasn't required of praetors to have been aediles, but they had to have at least been quaestors. They had to have at least held the lowest office on the courses. They had to be 39 years old, at least. Six of them were elected every year. So this was an important position. With the praetorship came a grant of imperium, the power of command. This was the first magistracy that gave you a grant of imperium. This is an important quality. It allows you to command military units. Praetors served very important judicial, political, and military functions in the Roman Republic. They were, in fact, the second highest rung on the ladder of regularly elected magistrates. And the fourth and final of the annually elected magistrates, regularly elected magistrates, the highest office in the state we've already seen, was the consulship. Consuls had to have been at least praetors. They had to be at least 42 years of age. And of course, only two of them were elected every year. You notice that as you go up the courses, the competition for office gets more intense. There are fewer spots. So you will be not only fighting your contemporaries as you go up, but also a backlog of people who failed in previous elections. Competition gets harder as you go up the office, up the run of offices. In addition to these annually elected magistrates, there are three other offices that we should look at before looking at some of the other characteristics of Roman office holding in the Republic. Every 5 years, special elections were held for the election of two men who were called censors. I say again, these elections only took place every 5 years. Censors came to be drawn from among the ex-consuls, so from the highest and most experienced men in the state, men who had been generals and leaders of the state. It goes without saying, of course, that the consuls were the chief political and military forces of the Roman Republic. They're the ones who commanded armies and so forth. So out of this pool of ex-consuls, every 5 years, two censors would be elected. They had extremely important duties that became so burdensome that it was common for the censors to hold office not for a year, but for 18 months. They had several vitally important duties. First is the one that gives them their name. They would hold a count, a census of Roman citizens. How many Roman citizens are there in the state? Secondly, having counted them, they would assign Roman citizens to varying classes, varying social classes, which we'll see play an important role in one of the major popular assemblies. They also had the job of seeing to the collection of taxes and of letting public contracts for construction works. For instance, the erection of an aqueduct or the building of a road. They would let the contract to the private company or companies who would carry out that job. There are two other duties that were of primary importance and gave them great political power were linked. They would review public morals. If they felt that luxury or high living had gotten out of hand, they could suggest legislation to counter it. And in connection with reviewing public morals, they also reviewed the role and register of the senators. And if they found that a senator was particularly debauched or dissolute, they could eject him from the Senate. You can see now the political importance of the censorship. You can eject your political opponents from the Senate saying that their parties last year were far too wild. Those guys shouldn't be sitting in our midst. So we have censors then elected every 5 years and sitting in office for 18 months by tradition. Again, technically, the censors held office for all 5 years that they were elected. But by tradition, it had become common for them to relinquish their powers after 18 months. We have records of some censors who insisted on trying to keep their powers afterwards, causing a tremendous stir. But this is a good example of how the Roman Republic is not really a matter of legislated constitutional powers, but of an accepted and traditional way of doing things. Another office, extraordinary magistracy, that we will look at is one that we've already mentioned, and that is the dictator. In extraordinary circumstances, in times of crisis, the Roman Republic had the potential to suspend the power of the consuls and concentrate it in the hands of a single man. He was called a dictator, a dictator, and he appointed a colleague, or at least a subordinate, should I say, the master of horse, the magister equitum, which reveals the essentially military nature of this office. The magister equitum was the assistant to the dictator. He was not his colleague. He couldn't veto him. And as long as the dictator was in office, he had sole control over the affairs of the state. Well, that's not quite true. He actually had sole control over the affairs that he was told to take care of, because a dictator would be chosen from among the ex-consuls, usually by the Senate, nominated by the Senate, and would be given a specific job. He would be given a dictatorship to take care of a specific problem. And as long as he was dealing with that problem, his word was paramount. It was normal in the Republic for dictators to hold office for 6 months, or until they had completed their task, whichever came first. So this is an extraordinary magistracy. It's not one that's elected or chosen every year, or even every 10 years. It only pops up whenever it's needed. In fact, by the end of the 3rd century BC, following the Hannibalic War, the dictatorship pretty much vanished. It was to be revived in the Roman Revolution in a very different guise, but it had become unpopular, presumably because it invested the holder with too much power, and this made the Roman aristocracy of the 2nd century nervous. They were very reluctant to convey this much power on any one individual. Finally, if in extraordinary circumstances both consuls were incapacitated or died in office, the ancient, very ancient office of interrex could be revived. The interrex was the old officer who had held office between kings in the old monarchic period, and he could be chosen once again, nominated from within the Senate, and then elected. He held office for 5 days, and his only function was to organize elections for consuls. So he was really a stopgap, and only appeared in extraordinary circumstances, if for whatever reason there were no consuls in power. So much then for the shape of the Roman magistracies. Complicated system of office holding, channeling the inexperienced into greater degrees of responsibility and power, and the whole thing operating as much through a generally accepted way of doing things, a generally accepted tradition, as anything else. In closing, I want to just draw some differences, some major differences between modern executive officers and Roman magistrates. There are 2 points in particular that I want to stress. A Roman magistrate was expected to carry out his duties in person. For any Roman magistrate to carry out a job, he wouldn't delegate it to an underling. He had to physically, personally show up to carry out the act. If he wanted to summon a meeting of the people, he could send a herald to convene the people, but if he wanted to propose legislation, he had to physically be there to do it. If he didn't show up, everyone would just go home and wait until he did show up. The second point is that ritual and public appearance played a vital role in defining the Roman magistrate. Magistrates who had imperium, for instance, were accompanied wherever they went by men called lictors. Lictors carried on their shoulders bundles of rods tied with purple ribbon that were called fasces. The fasces represented the imperium of the magistrate. The more lictors you had, the more imperium you had. Literally. Praetors had 6 lictors each, consuls had 12. So the imperium of a consul was considered twice as powerful as the imperium of a praetor. If a dictator was in power, he would have 24, i.e. all the imperium of both consuls combined. When outside Rome, an axe was added to the fasces, these bundles of rods, and this symbolized the power of imperium to inflict capital punishment with the axe or corporal punishment with the rods. How did you know who was a consul and who was a praetor? You saw when they came into the forum, you would physically see them surrounded by their lictors and their attendants. They would be in their full regalia. If they were going to carry out some form of duty, They would sit themselves down on an official seat. They would issue certain statements, carry out certain sacrifices. They would often be elevated above the crowd on a podium. This is why temples were very popular places for magistrates to sit on, because temples were built on high podiums. He would set up a chair on the podium.